Hello, John and Joe here. Now, you probably thought this day would never come, but believe it or not, Discast is back. And we're proud to announce that the next few months will see a series of releases in the form of some historical accounts about the sport and some personal interviews as well. Now, you might remember back in September 2009, we announced the Discast Decades project, which even then we had been working on for a couple of years. Now, the material we recorded for the Decades project will still be released, but in a slightly new format. So, essentially, each interview recorded will now be released as a standalone piece, rather than as part of one large episode edited together per decade.
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons for this. One was that we simply wanted to get the interviews out sooner rather than later, and we thought that it was fairest for the people who spoke to us that we released them relatively soon, and with the volume of work that it would take to edit them down, then we thought this was the best way to get them out. But also we thought that this format would probably work a bit better as well, because we had so much good quality and interesting material from the people who spoke to us that it's better, we thought, now if we don't have to edit the interviews down into a 1 or 2 hour show as we were going to do on a particular period, but rather can feature someone's whole journey through freestyle in the words that they gave it to us in. So that's the reason for that, and we hope this format will work well.
Yep. Now, today you're going to hear the very first of these Discast histories, and you'll hear a bit more about that in just a moment. But I can tell you that coming up in the next weeks and months, you'll hear also from Rob Freed and Roger Meyer talking about the 70s and 80s. Then you'll hear from Skippy Jammer, who guides us through the 80s and 90s from his perspective, and also from Dave and Amy Schiller.
And today you're going to hear from a true legend of the game, or one of the many legends that we spoke to. It's Dan Stork Roddick. You've already heard a snippet of our material from Stork when we released a Stork's Thoughts episode on the podcast a while back. But this is the main focus of the material he gave us, which was essentially charting his experience and the story of the growth of Frisbee and freestyle as a whole, starting in the 60s.
That's right. It was a real privilege to be able to interview Stork. And we actually spoke to him in his house, of all places. This was during our 2008 tour of the States. So without further ado, I'm sure you're all excited to hear it. I'll pass you over to Stork.
Okay, so we're going to chat to Dan about the earliest era, really, in freestyle history, the 70s. But Dan, before that, what was your experience of Frisbee and of knowing there was more you can do with a Frisbee than just the throw and catch that everyone else was doing?
Well, I think based on reading some things that were written in the early IFA news and other things that we've heard, yeah. I think that when people first got the early Pluto platters in their hands, so in our case this was 53, I was 5, when Dad and I first got that in our hands, we realized pretty quickly that it was something special, and one of the things about it was that the instructions weren't there. I mean, if a kid buys a video game now, it's laid out pretty much what you do, or you get a tennis racket. I mean, a kid doesn't speculate on, wow, I wonder what we can do with this, unless you're Jamie. that you just go play tennis. But with this, we didn't know. I mean, all it said was fly, flip, fly, straight, tilt to flip, curves, play catch, invent games. And so we took that pretty seriously. And Dad, who was and is a sportsman and coach, had brought a lot of analogies to this. I mean, he was a track and field coach for one, so that was a pretty big deal for me, that I thought of it as an implement. That wow, there's probably a lot of different things you could do with it. So, for instance, in our backyard, we played a space game where we would take turns saying, well, the mothership now is that larch tree over there, and let's see how many flights it takes to land it in the planted area below. Now, in retrospect, of course, that sounds a lot like disc golf, doesn't it? And I'd love to say that we thought of it as golf, but we didn't. Yeah. It was a space game.
Yeah.
And the fact that all the planets were around the outside edge, and of course it was great fun to catch it on Uranus. And Dad's also an astronomer, so that was kind of evocative for us, and we thought of it as a little spaceship that we were gliding around. But early in the going, we started playing a game that we called Eastern Trick Catch. And we must have played this for hundreds of hours in the backyard. And it was, I'm embarrassed to think how limited it was. But we had two rough circles, call them circles. I guess they were circles, but they were just, you know, worn out places on the grass that we knew that we stood. And I was just back there a few months ago and snuck back into the backyard of the people who own it now and pasted off. And it was about 25 meters apart. And what you did was that you threw to the other person. And it essentially was a strike zone, almost like guts would be, where you were trying to throw it pretty hard, but then on the catching end, your job was to trick catch it. And the trick catch universe to us was behind the head, between the legs, behind the back, or on the finger. And you got 1 point for doing any of those. And if you were off the ground when you made the catch, then you got double points. If you dropped, you lost a point. And so this ebbed and flowed back and forth between the two, throwing these catches that were in the strike zone, but hopefully difficult to deal with. But then the person's job was to quick catch it, essentially, on the other side. There was no delaying, no tipping, no delaying. That game actually lasted long enough to make it into Goldie Norton's book and to show up at Octad 74, which jumping way, way ahead. So this is almost 20 years later, that game still had life. And we had it in the first generation of Octad, which was really in New Brunswick, New Jersey, where the first time we brought these disparate elements of play together. That is, the West Coast people came out, like Victor was there, John Kirkland was there, Dave Johnson was there. There were about 30 people, I guess, that were kind of movers and shakers at the time. And I had this game in the listing of things to do. And Victor, in particular, just completely destroyed the game. I mean, he was so accurate and could throw so hard because, of course, he came from this guts background that we had never conceived of anything like this. And in one playing, that was the last time that Eastern Trick Catch ever was played because he just completely obliterated the game. So that was kind of jumping ahead. But we did that. And, of course, in playing that game, that developed my mentality of not just catching the disc, mm-hmm. but of doing something with it every time it came in. To fast forward again a lot, in 74, I guess it was, I traveled out and I visited WAMO, and I met with Goldie Norton, the guy who wrote the first book on Frisbee, and I forget what we were talking about. I was running some state championships in Pennsylvania at the time that included Eastern Trick Catch. and he said, you know, you ought to hook up with this guy out here who is a really good player. And I don't think he used the word freestyler because that word wasn't around. But he said, I've got to hook you up with Spider Wills. Spider plays in Laguna, and you got to get together with him. So somehow the arrangement was made, and I went down to play with Spider. And it was like two electrodes connecting. I mean, and we were so different. I mean, but yet doing the same thing, but so differently. And his game was so fluid, and I had never seen anything like it. And he did what would pass for a tip now, but the disc came in and he would give it a full-handed lift. And in general, the disc was wet lots of times. He would give it a full-handed lift and essentially be kind of getting the nose up, wind behind usually, and then he would turn and catch it after that. And, I mean, it was just completely mind-blowing to me. I mean, the idea of the first touch not being the catch. Yeah. And incredibly, he had never thought of behind the head. You know, that's my great contribution, that I showed him behind the head, you know, and he's going, oh, wow, you know, I mean, your hand turns that way, and, you know. But, I mean, it was just, this is Shaw's Cove in Laguna. I mean, I'm an East Coast boy, you know, Presbyterian, Eagle Scout, you know, and I'm talking to him, and he's saying, well, you know, what do I do for work? Oh, gee, I don't know. I shoot some film for Bruce Brown on a surf movie that's coming out, and then I, you know, I was a lab rat for Timothy Leary, and you know, it's not, you know, and you know, we're done with the jam, and he's going, oh well, let's get cleaned off. You know, he just drops his shorts, and I'm going, geez, right here. I mean, just we just take our shorts off, right? Yeah, why? What? You know, I'm going, well, you know, I kind of just, oh come on, you know, and I mean, just talking about life in general, of going, well, so what are you going to do? Oh, I don't know. I mean, you mean tomorrow? I said, no, I mean, in general. No, well, I don't try to think much more beyond tomorrow. I mean, the way I figure it, the whole rest of the world is, you know, they're busting their ass all year to get 2 weeks off, you know. I bust my ass 2 weeks and I have 50 weeks off. You do the math. You know, and I mean, I mean, it was just mind-blowing. And it was the beginning. I mean, it was the first of any of the West Coast guys I met. And, you know, Baudet followed and Z and,
you know.
Well, not that day, at least. He wasn't airbrushing yet. I mean, with that lift, I mean, he was knocking on the door, but he didn't actually.
What year was that?
74, probably. Because I know this because when I first came to IFT, this would be maybe 74 or 75. And this is my first seeing of Victor. And we had Goldie's book in hand. So we knew about the sidearm, but we assumed it was a joke. We had tried it, nothing came of it, and we thought, because it was so much was tongue in cheek at that time, we thought, well, it's a joke. And Jimmy Scala and I drove up there together and we were all preparing to play Guts. The first person we see is Victor throwing Macho Sidewinder. This is the first guy we see. Ironically, probably the best sidearm, you know, ever is the first one we see. So seeing Victor's Macho Sidewinder was like just absolutely, absolutely mind-blowing. And at the same event, I mean, that was a giant leap for me. I mean, I thought I knew about discs, and Roger Barrett was there, and I'd never seen mold marks before, didn't, you know, realize that discs were different weights, and you know, and I don't think this was CPI yet, but anyway, the Highland Avenue Aces were there. And between the Guts points, when someone would just throw a courtesy shot back to return the disc, Alan Blake, when it came in, would tip the disc several times, four or five times before the catch. I just couldn't even comprehend it. I mean, it was like he was an alien. I I said to Jimmy, I said, well, he's got to be adding spin.
Yeah.
I mean, it couldn't continue to fly on the original spin. I mean, it's got to be that he's somehow twisting it to do that. And we got to talk with him a little bit and try it clumsily, but I can't tell you how badly it went. I mean, here's me who had thrown now for, what was it, 10, 12 years. My first attempts to do that tip, I mean, my hands were beat up and bleeding from all the tries to just do these simple tips. I mean, it was just crazy that here was this completely different way of seeing it. And of course the breakthrough of realizing that the disc could continue to fly and that you could control it. I mean, that was giant. So I took that back to New Jersey, and then we started to have a game where, like, Flash Eberle and Irv Kalb and I, who Irv eventually became my freestyle partner, from being just an ultimate buddy, we would try to see how many we could tip before we caught it, and numbers was a big deal at that point. That the rumor that we had was there was this guy in Berkeley, and I think it was maybe Gottlieb, who had tipped it 15 times. That's what we heard. That was the Holy Grail. You know, if you could possibly somehow get it 15 times, and that seemed impossible. 12, you know, it just, nobody could do more than 12. But this guy had done 15. And I mean, that whole breakthrough was so slow that I can't even recount how challenging that all seemed. And then to move to jump even farther ahead, the idea of the delay with that, at least coming to us, because we were in New Brunswick, New Jersey, that came to us out of New York City. And the combination, and you have to talk with these guys to see who did it first, but the Kerry Colmar, Freddie Haft combination in Central Park, doing the delays. When that came on the scene, then there was no stopping things. I mean, the idea that you could continue to have it spin. Now, to again get a data point to remember this, in probably 75, I started using a thimble that I had taped to my index finger to essentially zing the disc up. And while Kerry, and the first time I saw airbrushing was from Kerry and Cray and company and the various people from Central Park. But as hard as this is to believe, Kerry Colmar could not consistently get the disc up into brushing attitude. So the big advantage I had in that season was the ability to zing it up into positive attack with this and then brush out for leaping catch, let's say.
Yeah. So would you be using the rim there?
The rim to get it up into the right attitude for brushing. Yeah. And although Kerry was a better brusher, and most of the Washington Square, I guess Washington Square was up and going by then, I'm not sure, Central Park at least. But just to give you an idea of how primitive our control was, Kerry Colmar couldn't get the disc into brushing angle. I mean, now it just seems inconceivable, but I can remember a Jersey Jam, one of our events in New Jersey, when I believe it was Freddie, showed the delay for the first time. And I can remember talking to a fellow judge and saying, what happened there? What was he tipping it? And I think back on that now, I wonder even more so, I wonder what would have happened to the judging panel had a 2008 possession taken place. That is, my guess is that that they wouldn't have been able to see it. That is, I think it would have been so beyond their level of comprehension that they would have mutually looked at each other and say, I missed that. What was it? And that makes me think that aliens are walking amongst us because we're just not ready to see them. Because I think in terms of the sociology of knowledge, I if you don't know about attitude correction and delay and rim work and brushing and all of that, a 2008 move in 1975 would have been invisible. I don't know. So in terms of the genesis, when we got those tools in hand, 75, 76, that was so energizing. And of course, I'm sure other people who talk to you will recount the fact that everybody freestyled. That is, when disc players got together, everybody freestyled. It wasn't like, oh, there's this group of freestylers, and then there's golfers, and then there's ultimate players. I mean, it was everybody jammed. And it was like in the early Rose Bowls, people just couldn't stop. I mean, people would be up all night in the middle of the night out jamming, and when you wake up in the morning, there'd be people telling you about three new moves that somebody did last night. And now it's that you can touch the disc on top when it's going by, and then that makes the nose go up, and then everybody would try that. And it was exciting in the sense that everybody felt like they could make a contribution because things were being developed all the time. And different styles. I mean, Chuck Schultz, here's a guy who you wouldn't think. I mean, think, well, that's not the right body for freestyle. But, you know, the whole macho, powerful, quick catch throw and delivery, everybody was making their contribution to the game. And it just was tremendously exciting and a fabulous time to be playing. And it's one of the reasons that I'm most delighted with the success that we had competitively during that time, because in a lot of ways it was some of the most exciting time to be a freestylist, because the sky was the limit. I mean, we thought we could do anything.
Okay, so Dan, you mentioned that the first time any form of trick play in disc sports was taken to the Octad tournament in 1974. So after that initial showing of freestyle, or well, just Eastern Trick Catch as it was called back then, what happened then in some terms of tournaments after that, with the freestyle tournaments starting to happen quite a lot? So were they going in with all the main sort of overall events?
Well, I'm always a little rough on remembering the exact dates, and we'd have to look them up. But yeah. But in terms of the first contest that would remind us of a competition that we have today, the Canadian Championships, and I want to say 74. That's probably about right. There was a free form contest on the Toronto Island, and it was judged by the players. And the guidelines, I probably have them floating around somewhere. And it was won, incidentally, by Jim Kenner of Discraft fame, and Ken Westerfield. Also in it were the Chicago people, Highland Avenue Aces types, I think I played maybe with Bruce Koger there from Chicago, and my eventual partner Irv Kalb was there. But that was the and the Rochester people. Sorry, but that, as far as I know, was the first competition, and where we, I believe it was probably ranked the other players, and it was specifically called free form. Which I wouldn't have remembered, except I've got some little second place trophy someplace that says that's what it was. I do remember that one of the moves of the event, and I think maybe Charles Tipps described this, one of the moves of the event that he said was a breakthrough in his mentality, was that I threw to Bruce Koger, and then, brace yourself, ran down, and while he tipped it, I ended up catching my own throw. Oh, you don't look like that's too astounding. At the time, the idea that it could be sustained so long on the other end of the throw that the thrower could actually catch his own throw, that was out of this world. That kind of unbelievable control. But it ends up that was kind of the beginning of the time period where we did start to look to execution. Not that the development of moves ended, obviously it didn't, but to a certain extent you might think of it like language, that this prehistory that we've been talking about were the very slow beginnings of development of language and vocabulary. That just it was laborious just to begin to get the words themselves to have the conversation. Mm. And that event probably was the first time that we started to understand that the pieces could be put together in such a way that you could have a conversation between two players, and that the more words, moves that you had, the more intriguing that conversation exchange could be. So after that, competition started to be more frequent. I think that is the last time that free form was used as a title, yeah. Because I know in 75, which was the zenith year for Irv and me, where we won the Canadian championship, it was definitely freestyle. And then the American Flying Disc Open drew a big field to Rochester. It was also freestyle. And then kind of the culmination of the year was the freestyle championship in the Rose Bowl as part of the world championship. And that was definitely freestyle, termed freestyle as well. And we were fortunate enough to win all three of those, which was kind of astounding, because it's the same year that Victor and John were touring with the Globetrotters. And I mean, they were playing all the time, true pros, and everybody was learning so many things so fast, and frankly the technical skills of the New Yorkers were coming on so rapidly that you just had no idea what the next thing you were going to see coming out of Washington Square and the park with Kerry and Freddie Haft and Crave and Sickle. And the Washington Square people, this may have been a little pre-Dwork and Felberbaum and those guys, but that was all starting to grow. Jerry Linus, Dave Perrell, I mean, there was a pretty big and creative group growing there. So it was a good year to win a lot of them, because the talent was coming on fast.
Right.
And then when Irv and I came off of that tour and started doing demos, then we were starting to attract young talent. I can remember a demo we did somewhere in Paramus, New Jersey or something like that, and there were a pair of what appeared to be kind of identical brothers watching us and watching every move we did. I can't remember their name, Velasquez or Velasquez. Yeah, that's what it was. Velasquez. Jens was just talking to me about that the other day, saying, you know, we went out and watched that demo and we just said, we got to do that stuff. And needless to say, they learned pretty well. So after that, I mean, we were having it in the Octad and Jersey Jam. And I think there actually was a pretty big event in Chicago that had some freestyle, and Toronto had it every year. So it was a good time to be a freestylist, and people were developing. And then, I really haven't mentioned Northern California much during that time period. Berkeley had kind of kind of broken up at that time, and kind of the nexus of Northern California play moved a little farther north to be more like Sonoma, Modesto, where now we're talking about early Skippy Jammer and Evan Furtado and Mike Young and Andy Yates and those guys. So now it was starting to be, at least our impression was, my God, you know, there's everybody's into it now. Then once the NAS meets got going, the North American Series, it, because it was a required event in the overall to qualify for the Rose Bowl, I can remember, I think it was maybe 1976 or 7, must have been 1976. And now we're talking about a period of time where you're starting to see the Evan Furtados and G. Rose and Corey Bassos and all of those people. The preliminary round on Stork Field at Santa Barbara had, I remember specifically, had 13 preliminary pools in the freestyle. Whoa. The entire field was covered, and the pools probably had to be at least six teams. So now we're talking about people like Sammy Schatz, and things like, I think that meet might have even featured the turnover, which was another example of something that, I mean, the mythology was, can't be done. Like the planet will stop spinning if a disc is turned over, because see, there's physics that make it that it's impossible. Well, it showed up at that meet, and now we were having people like who was the really really young kid from up north, played with Steve Gottlieb, Hal Erickson, and
Monica Lou,
Peter Blurm. I mean, where. It was just such a rich time. I mean, you can imagine with 13 pools. I mean, there were people popping up who you, surprise, surprise, didn't know intimately, who were great. I mean, I think maybe that might have even been a Chipper Bro intro of maybe one of his first times to compete. Wow. Here's this willowy kid who can twist his arm in and out of his leg five times and catch it. And so around that time, we really were thinking that that there was just going to be no end to the development of freestyle, that it was just going to go crazy.
One thing I was going to just go back to earlier on the initial tournaments happening in the mid-70s, how were they judged back then? Was it just simply people sort of gave their view of the overall impression of the routine, or was it marked like on certain skills like quite frequently? How was it done?
The answer of how we judged during that period is a tough one, because the answer is pretty much any way that you can imagine. We struggled and argued and experimented with pretty much every approach. In the early going, there was a lot of gymnastic influence, and Jim Palmieri in particular out of Rochester gave us a lot of direction in that venue, because he was familiar with gymnastics, and it would take a long time to track through all of the different things that were tried, but we definitely had some attempts at gymnastic style judging, usually focusing on the components of difficulty, variety, and execution as the primary ones. The results on that were always difficult, as that continues today. And then there was a time period, and you have to remember, it was a time period where the IFA basically was directing almost all of the competitions. So out of my office flowed most of the decision making about how competitions were going to be run.
Was the IFA, is that the International Frisbee Association, just for people that don't know?
Yeah, the International Frisbee Association, okay, yeah. Sponsored by WAMO. So I was hired by WAMO, and so all the money that got the committees, not that there weren't committees. I mean, we had committees of people. It wasn't just the people who worked in my office, but but the driving force was coming out of the IFA offices. Right, yeah. There was a period of time when the attempts at objective judging was going so badly that at the beginning of one of the seasons, and I don't remember what season, it was maybe 77, 78, I don't know, they washed together. I came out with a dramatic break from that said, okay, we're going to do a ranking system. And I think we actually used voting sticks where people voted and ranked the players. It was guided voting. And it still used a lot of the other components, but it didn't attempt to break things down into the specificity that we were trying to quantify previously.
Okay, Dan, so back to the early era sort of time, the 70s, who would you say were the most influential players in terms of influencing the direction of the sport, and who are the main stars of that time? Obviously, it's difficult, you know, it's hard to include everyone, but who comes to mind as that sort of a player?
Wow, that is a difficult question, because it's a little like putting a an invitation list together for a wedding that you have to be careful. But with that warning, let me kind of free associate a little bit, trying to go chronologically. For me, of course, my first influence was my dad, and all of the early play that we had, which mainly was with a Pluto platter on the back of a motorcycle at campgrounds, was with him. And just a little insight on the development there. When we saw our first pro model, this would be the 108-gram intercollegiate model from WAMO, we were aghast because it was so heavy and so insensitive in comparison to the Pluto platter that we really enjoyed. So that puts it a little bit in context. And incidentally, I actually started out with a Pipco flying saucer. And when I first saw Frisbee on one of the discs that we had, I thought it was a ridiculous name. I mean, it seemed, because they were flying saucers, as I said, we played a space game. And so Frisbee, we just didn't get it at all. It just seemed really silly. I guess that continues. Let me see, people that, when I started to get in contact with people, I think I mentioned that visit to the IFT in 74. So 73, 74, meeting Spider Wills was a big deal that kind of opened my mind. All the people that I met at IFT, which ironically is mainly a guts event, but it happened that these West Coast people came out, which would be the Berkeley people primarily. That meeting Victor, and Roger Barrett, Chuck Schultz, and when did I first meet you, Z? Did I meet you at that IFT or after that?
I didn't go to those early IFTs. I went to the later, some of the later ones.
Maybe I met you out here then first, in 75 or so.
Yeah, probably.
But that connection, and of course you have to remember that in even 75, the connections between East and West Coast were not like they are now. I mean, the idea of getting a phone call from Los Angeles, I mean, that was a giant deal. I mean, it was wow, there's a guy on the phone and he says he's from Los Angeles. I mean, and just how parochial my thinking was. I mean, even when I moved out here in 75, I came out and I thought, oh, I'll be jamming with Victor and the guys in Berkeley like every weekend, because I'll just be in Los Angeles. You know, it turned out it was like 7 hours away. I mean, but the it all started to go pretty fast when we came out and when WAMO pulled together the people for those early World Frisbee Championships. And I think even the most violent detractor from WAMO's influence during that time would have to look back and say that the catalyst that produced was just an amazing one. That is, connections were made and people met and ideas were exchanged that were really mind-blowing. I mean, because prior to that, all of us were kind of isolated, crazy people. And to see other crazy people right face to face, I mean, it was just a bizarre thing. And that's why nobody could go to bed, because he couldn't get enough of it. I mean, here's a guy who actually, like you, cares about how you change the angle of a spinning disc and is wondering how long he can keep it spinning on his fingertip. I mean, so the impressions and the connections that were made there. I met Tom Baudet in one of those early visits, and Tom was a tremendous influence on my thinking in all regards of my life, not just disc sports, but I mean, of just a level of mentality of thinking about what are the games really about, you know, what kind of contribution do they make to our lives? What does it really mean to play? All of those things were, you know, just incalculable contributions to my thinking. Meeting and I earlier talked about some of the, let's call them pods of people. The Berkeley group, as I said, had a tremendous influence on, especially in terms of the athleticism of the event. That there was a temptation, I think, particularly in the early going of thinking of Frisbee as kind of an effete thing. That, well, it's kind of, you know, just a nice play catch back and forth and dance around. There wasn't much dancing around for the Berkeley guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were power players. Yeah. And so that really put an athletic edge on and made us think it was a sport. When we saw the velocity and accuracy that they threw with and Bob May and the big distance throwers of the time, we realized that it was an implement that had tremendous potential. So boy, individual names. And it's trying to stay in the freestyle realm, I have to say that my partner, Irv Kalb, back in New Brunswick, New Jersey, Irv came to me initially as an ultimate player, but we quickly developed an affinity for freestyle, and of course we had tremendous success together in the mid 70s, and he was a perfect complement to my playing style. So I mean, I couldn't have done any of it without Irv. The New York City group in particular brought a creative, artistic sophistication to play that added a great amount. I mean, when you take just the basics of basic skill set, like the delay and airbrushing and control tipping, all of that, we really kind of were continually trying to one-up one another. And then the development of the Washington Square people. Now when you're starting to see Richie Smits, Joey Hodocklin. I mean, geez, I can't believe I mentioned Joey yet. When those guys came on the scene and had this unbelievable dedication to play, and really kind of a whole different approach of where we were. Let's say in the Irv and I, it was a kind of a big running game and really kind of a very variety, crowd-pleasing mentality. And the Wizards, and now we'll add in Dworkin, Felberbaum, and Cotter Michaels, where they started to delve into the difficulty of control, the interest in developing both spins, in the John Dworkin in particular, all the variations with twirling and disc control, just mind-blowing things, with basically saying the crowd be damned, that I'm not Doc Severinsen, you know, I'm not playing for the Tonight Show crowd, I'm playing for me. I mean, this is after the club closes. This is the hot jazz that maybe nobody else even understands, and who cares? When that thread started to come into play of just seeing this unbelievable level of control and difficulty, that blended into the fabric in a way. So when you think of all these things coming together, the free-spirited West Coast play and the variety we were showing and the difficulty control from the New York group, and now then we start to bring in international the Canadians. Oh yeah, Bill King, John Anthony, of course, you know, I didn't mention again since their first win, Kenner and Westerfield. But of course, way early in the going, I mean, they were making money on the streets of Toronto before most of us knew how to catch between our legs, you know. So in terms of showing people what you know, what great style was, Victor's play with John with the Globetrotters, you still won't find too many showmen better than they were. If we had that film, it would still be as thrilling as it was. People look now at Jens and Irwin tape from 76 and are blown away. When those guys came on, the Europeans that then got interested and started to come over and connect with us, again, another benefit of the WAMO Championships, bringing Europeans over and melding them into this group, where we started to meet the Adrian Wainwrights and the Khans and the Jason Sulkies and all of those folks. So there really was an eclectic blend. Have I missed any?
Bird T-shirt.
Oh, jeez. This is a hopeless task.